Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation, heard at americascannabisconversation.com. We're part of the W420 Radio Network, and each week we provide you with information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and recreational cannabis industry. W420RadioNetwork.com. Time now for the lowdown on another high-time experience. Here's 420 lifestyle correspondent Rich Walkoff.
Well, here at the Emerald Cup, at the Harvest Ball at Santa Rosa Fairgrounds, about an hour north of San Francisco, you run into some eclectic characters. And we got one here today on America's Cannabis Conversation. It's Michael the Wolfman Siegel, or Michael Wolf Siegel, who is a self-described OG weed man from a long time ago, who also did some hard time. So you have stood the test of time, young man, and tell me a little bit about your history and why it's so compelling.
Well, I know that it's become more common for people to have consumed cannabis in utero, like when their mom was carrying them. Well, that happened to me in the mid-50s, and it happened that who my mom was smoking with was Jack Kerouac. They were part of the circle because of my father being a musician who played violin. He was Crazy A.B. Siegel. But you come up further. First time I ever consumed pot voluntarily, I was 12. I went out and hitchhiked up and down across the highways of southern Oregon and northern California in 1971. What I did that with was seeds that I had saved up over the winter. At that point, I was one of the biggest pot dealers in Bellingham, Washington, a pretty good-sized college town, which by the 70s meant a lot of pot smokers in the college population. I grew my first indoor crop in 1977 or 9, I can't remember which. I continued to grow outdoors for quite a while, but then shifted over entirely to indoors just because in the Pacific Northwest it's easier to go that way.
Yeah.
I became involved with a company called Hydrotech. They're not really active anymore, but the owner of Hydrotech was a guy named Kevin Bjornson. Kevin and I began writing together as The Farmer in the Sky. We had a column in Sinsemilla Tips that ran from 1982 to 1988. From that pulpit, most of what is currently considered state of the art was written about back in the mid-80s. People don't know how devastating Operation Green Merchant was to the advance of what I call cannabiculture. But back to my personal history. In 1989, Operation Green Merchant busted me, and I had to go away for what ended up being 15 years. They originally indicted me for a little over 12,000 plants. I pled down to 3,999.
Now, you did the hard time. Where did you do that, and what did the experience, what was that like for you?
Well,
I mean, for a guy growing a medicinal, recreational, magical plant to do 15 years, that's just an outrage.
I'm not going to lie. At that point in my life, I was doing it for the money. I was doing it for the freedom that money is, freedom to and freedom from. I was able to take care of a great number of people's needs. I was able to contribute heavily to getting rid of what I refer to as pothibition. By the time that happened, I had put $250,000 into legalization. I was the third non-attorney life member of National Normal.
So a pioneer in the legalization, but paid the ultimate price, really. I mean, good chunk of your life behind bars. For what? For growing?
No one should have to do prison time for a plant. That doesn't make sense. It's like God gives you, I'm going to get religious, in Genesis we're told that every seed bearing plant is for us to eat thereof, and most classical Hebrew scholars say that that means to use. And there's a number of things that, going a little more modern to what Christians profess to believe, you're supposed to feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, heal the sick, visit the shut-in, clothe the naked, and there's only one plant that you can, or one thing out there that you can do all of that with, and that's the cannabis plant. The therapeutic values, the medicinal values are incredible, but they are just the surface of the gifts that this plant gives. And if my having done what I've done makes that happen and become the way we go, I don't have kids because I was in prison when I would have. It would thrill the shit out of me if my legacy. But now I want to talk about something really, really, really important, which is a big part of why I'm here. I'm working on something called the Restoration Act. The point of the Restoration Act is to bring back the good parts of 215, which means restoring collectives. And although the statute says that there's no statutory entity of being a collective, there's a really strong legal argument for that, because it's been part of the law, that definition has been referred to in like three editions of the guidelines, that under a legal principle called adoption by reference, that it's in the law. There's this really good suit going, but part of the suit is a request for a TRO, and the point of the TRO is to suspend the operations of an illegal law, which would cause chaos, except that we also offer a smooth 280E exempt path across the chaos to 215, the best of 215, and the important things from 64, the expungements, the problem here is that social use, what's called adult use, isn't allowed internationally, and the United States is signatory to a treaty called the United Nations Single Convention on Dangerous Narcotics. That's the right end. And even if the federal government wanted to legalize social use, what I think of as recreational, that can't be done without first formally withdrawing from a treaty obligation, and it'd be legal. Now, you know, everyone might go poo-poo, big deal, but it's important, you know? We got to keep our word. We haven't done it to the indigenous Americans, but that's a whole nother subject.
Yeah. So when you're talking about a restorative justice for growers and people like yourself who were punished, you know, unmercifully, you're talking about changing a whole paradigm, and then the taxation in many states is so exorbitant that it's almost encouraging the black market to thrive even more so.
Taxation of an illegal act, when that illegal act was suborned by the government under false pretenses, means that you have been victimized under color of state law. That's one of the basis of what we're bringing, the suit we're bringing. We are coming at, we have smoking gun for everyone from Brown through Banta, the attorney generals. We can show where there's been malfeasance or incompetence. Take your pick. There's no other alternative for what those two things were. And we're putting it in front of a judge based on United States Supreme Court and California Supreme Court decisions. It's going to get knocked down. 94 is going to go away. The paradigm is changing radically. There's two ways it can go. The easiest one is they create Schedule 6 in the Controlled Substance Act and put every over-the-counter drug, including cannabis, on Schedule 6.
Instead of Schedule 1, which lumps it with heroin and methamphetamine, right, and other more dangerous narcotics.
Methamphetamines are Schedule 2.
Well, that's bizarre.
No, there's medical uses. Schedule 1 is for the things that the government wanted to say had no legitimate medical application. Never mind the patent on its use.
Well, how misguided and bizarre is that?
It's kind of like Bizarro World or like Orwell's 1984, where words mean the opposite of what they mean, yeah, and the meaning changes when it suits the government.
Well, who are your allies and who are the enemies?
The allies are all of us that really do want compassionate use based, as the people of California have said, in a not-for-profit collective structure, which doesn't mean people can't make a good living because of equitable equitable
compensation?
Yeah,
not so much.
Yeah, but it's not the word from this. With that equitable, equitable reimbursement. When you get old, sometimes that shit happens. Okay, so equitable reimbursement can be a decent living. And as long as everything that's within it stays with an ownership that's a collective, there's a place in California's tax laws, section 6006, where it describes a transfer from one entity to a related entity, and it's a very good parallel for what goes on within a collective that has, for instance, managing members or distributive, you know. So basically there's really, really major problems with 94, and it can be replaced with what is 215 and the best of 64, the things that people voted for in 64 and more.
Yeah, and those have all been favoring major corporations in a huge way, which undermine the small grower, and it certainly over taxes or exorbitant taxes for consumers in the, you know, cannabis market.
In the Restoration Act, we go back to, we're not gonna, you know, pull a socialistic takeover of people that already have stuff, but they get to finish out their licenses under 64. But the way we would do it is under the Restoration Act, it transitions back, and you there's the caps, and you earn your way up. If you comply with the environmental stuff, if you do all of that, then your canopy grows. The thing about out-of-state investors, multi-state operators, killing off the legacy market is not acceptable. And people refer to it as the legacy market. I went to prison for 15 years. I put hundreds of thousands of dollars into this, which is my legacy, because I don't have kids. And so this is what I'm leaving you guys. Yeah, and I did a lot of stuff. And the thing I'm gonna get a little egotistical for a second, but it is a verifiable truth. No one who has grown two crops or more has failed to have used at least one technique or technology that I brought to growing cannabis.
Well, that's a hell of a legacy. And give me a pearl or a gem of wisdom in the growing world.
Watch your plant. She'll tell you she needs something or if she doesn't. It doesn't hurt to study science and keep an open mind at the same time.
Cool. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your mom on Jack Kerouac, you know, on the road back in the 50s. And you're saying she was consuming cannabis when she was pregnant, which is apparently today by medical standards a real no-no. But you came out okay, and I don't know if we'd advocate it, but tell me what your perspective is on that.
I have two other siblings, both of whom, as I was, were exposed to cannabis all the way through pregnancy. My younger brother, much younger brother, graduated from Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado with honors, became a hedge fund broker, controlling billions of dollars, now just is like number three or number four in the University of California's pension system in running that. So he's not a dummy. I should also mention at one point he was the foremost European descended, non-Hispanic European descended practitioner of an art called capoeira, which is a pretty intense physical martial art and exercise. My sister, a year older than my younger brother, went to a Catholic prep school, which I helped pay for, and parlayed that into a full-blown scholarship to a really good small liberal arts school, Mount Holyoke. Got a Truman scholarship, a Truman grant after college to go to Europe and Africa. She went to Africa and ran, I left part out. She went and studied abroad for a year, came back, full-blown scholarship to Columbia University in public administration, became the chief financial officer for Africa for World Concern. Not stupid, okay, and pretty healthy. So I can only talk about me and mine from what I really know. And from what I know is, I think most moms and dads, I mean, I'm all fucked up in the head because I didn't have a real good childhood, but most moms and dads want their kids to come out as healthy and smart as me and my family did, with my mom having smoked pot all three pregnancies.
That's pretty crazy. Michael Siegel, they call him the Wolf here on America's Cannabis Conversation.
Actually, I'm called Wolf by my friends, but I write as the Farmer in the Sky. As the Farmer in the Sky was the name of the column that ran from 82 to 88. It's also the 3 years of podcasting that I did. It's the Farmer in the Sky Radio Hour, one session of which, the October 26, 1985 session, is the only time that Ed Rosenthal and George Cervantes have ever worked on a project together. They did it because we were the three main stallions in Tom Alexander's stable in Sinsomia Tips magazine.
Well, it's an amazing story. Thanks for sharing. Our audience is going to love it. And because you were the OG, man. Go way back to the day, but still rocking it now.
There's stuff coming. There's stuff coming. Like what I was writing about in the mid-80s is widely regarded as state-of-the-art now. There's stuff coming that looks at light as how radio signal works. And with that knowledge, consider that from outer space, we can beam back coherent packets of electronic information that are decipherable, aiming at this little tiny planet moving through space at tens of thousands of miles an hour, and get it right. Now, given that we know that from over 100 years of studying light, why do we not apply some of those things to what we know, or excuse me, to radio? Why do we not apply those to light? Because light is radio at a million times the speed. So I started looking at that and figured out that if you're growing indoors, you can grow sun. It's not easy, but you can grow as close to sun as it gets indoors by putting back what's missing. It turns out that you have to have the full range of light from 280 nanometers down to 780 nanometers. I said down because higher frequency is lower number, is shorter wavelength, but and carries more energy. So I fell into studying light, and I'll cut it after this one. But what really is cool about that is that it's got me to a point where I'm pretty convinced we're most of the way to Tesla's beamed energy, the free beamed energy. And understanding wave theory, and that wave theory is the controlling set of rules over how waves behave. If you look at what constructive interference is in radio, what harmonic reinforcement is in music, and understand that you can reinforce and amplify by reinforcing because you cut back the rate at which the energy dissipates as it travels. Right, every energy radiates. I know
it's a little esoteric. You're getting into the weeds, and we started out talking about the weed, but it's all good. Yeah. So we'll have to cut it there because I don't have a PhD in physics.
Neither do I. Neither do I, but everything that I'm really, really interested in, I dig into, and pot has been my obsession pretty much since I was a little kid. Until I was 13, I thought I was going to grow up and be a lawyer, but I discovered that I had morals and ethics, so I became a dope dealer instead.
That's a good way to sum it up. On the America's Cannabis Conversation, Rich Wallkopf here at the Emerald Cup Harvest Ball, Santa Rosa, California. Ladies and gentlemen, the doctor is in the house. Yes, here we are at MJ BizCon in Las Vegas, the largest weed conference, and I'm with Dr. Lance McCarthy, who works as a board advisor for Minorities for Medical Marijuana. We hooked up last night at the get-together in town. It was off the hook, and you gave an impassioned speech about connecting people to opportunities in the marijuana industry for minorities. And give me an overview how challenging it is for people of color to get in this booming industry.
The difficulty in the industry has always been the lack of access to capital. You have the skill set, been able to work in the industry, but it's always been the lack of access to capital. So with Minorities for Medical Marijuana, we try to galvanize the organization to be able to help minorities get into and sustain in the industry.
Yeah, now who is backing you? Who's funding your projects?
Good question. We have quite a bit of major corporate donors. Some of the major players, Turnleaf, Curaleaf, Hawthorne, a lot of the major players in the cannabis space are our sponsors and partners.
Yeah. Is there progress being made, or is that glass ceiling thicker than ever?
I think there is being slowly but surely some progress. But when you look at the comparative analysis of those who have been disproportionate on the legal system for minorities, we believe that we have to continue to make more of a significant impact as we move this agenda forward.
Yeah, now is the government kind of bringing some affirmative action type programs into play to help minorities get a foothold in the industry?
Good question. You know, everything is statewide because it's not federal yet. So we work with state legislators to make sure that you have social equity on those state applications. And quite honestly, a lot of states give extra benefits by having a social equity or minority partner in their application.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain states that are more receptive and more favorable and others that you're still banging on the door to get in?
Another good question. Yes. What we believe is one of the best pieces of legislation is in Illinois. In Evansville, Illinois, they were able to look at not only social equity, but also reparations from new taxes that came from marijuana and cannabis will go to reparations and assist minorities. So we believe that's one of the best pieces of legislation we've seen on a state level.
And how about the flip side? How about the more challenging states?
Yeah, well, you know, there's some states that are very challenging because the cost to get into entry is very difficult. And again, we're trying to incentivize by having social equity. So yes, you have the wide extreme, mm-hmm. the benefit and those who aren't.
Yeah, so do we have a percentage in the industry that minorities represent in terms of ownership of dispensaries or businesses and the like?
I would say that it's less than 2% of the industry.
Wow.
Yeah, and you have 40% that are in prison because of cannabis. So that's a very strong variance of how we have to flip that number and be able to change the game.
Yeah, now expunging criminal records for possession of marijuana, that's been the rage of late, but still the disproportionate impact on people of color remains a sticking point big time.
Yes, Minorities for American Marijuana are very excited that we do these expungement clinics all across the country. We've done them in California, Missouri, New Jersey. So we really try to help people come out in one day and get their records expunged so they can have a second chance to get back into the marketplace.
So that's kind of a legal aid opportunity?
Yes. We deal with the local lawyers, legal aid, other volunteers. It's really a great event. We do about 9 to 12 on a Saturday morning. We've done everywhere from 50 to 100 people in one day.
That's awesome. So, you know, you're armed with information and professional advice that goes a long way. Now, your social activism goes beyond this realm, and you shared with me last night about your involvement with the George Floyd's family.
Yes, sir.
And you got to tell me more about that and tell our listeners in America's Cannabis Conversation.
Yeah, I've been an activist in economic development for years. It actually started with the Urban League. I was the president of the Urban League in Orlando. Then it went to Ferguson. I was able to create an economic development platform in Ferguson. And most recently, the George Floyd Foundation. I've been appointed the economic advisor to be able to help create the program, social economic justice, technology and youth, as well as workforce and entrepreneurship.
And how has that been going? How are you being received? And you talked about corporate funding for M4MM, Minorities for Medical Marijuana. How about in the George Floyd family pursuits?
Yes, well, the name is very recognized. What we're doing these first 60 days is making brand awareness. People know the name, but now we're making the industry understand what we're doing. And then from there, we'll be able to create partnerships and create funding.
Yeah. Now, how long has M4MM been around and how's the growth going?
Great. It's been around a little bit over 5 years, 33 states across the country, three countries. I have won numerous awards, the top 100 in diversity, the top 100 in cannabis, featured in Forbes magazine for our boot camps, helping minorities get into the play. We've had significant growth from 5 years.
Well, that's great. But interesting double-edged sword. You talk about the disproportionate punishment of minorities for cannabis possession or sale and the lack of opportunities to get in the industry. You're getting it at both ends.
Yes, sir. It is a dichotomy, but we know that it's significant. We know this industry is not going anywhere. We want to make sure that we have impact for minorities from all levels, from growing, dispensaries, distribution, the whole gamut.
Okay, so where do you bring your message? I mean, here at MJ BizCon in Las Vegas, you have the absolute biggest in the industry worldwide. So how do you get it out? Other than looking so dapper, we got to take some photos to show everybody this man's like GQ City.
Yes, we do conferences all across the country. We go to the National Cannabis Conferences. We go into states and do state conferences. We do quite a bit. We have, again, 33 chapter leaders around the country. We do a lot of online education, so we get the word out.
Yeah. Now, are you optimistic that progress is going to accelerate, or perhaps are you feeling as though there is just a lot of headwinds?
No, I think we're going to make continuously impact and continue to grow. We can't go anywhere but up. We constantly get momentum with large corporations and small corporations, so we're making a significant impact.
Yeah, and last night we heard from Naomi Tosh, the daughter of the late, great reggae man, Peter Tosh,
yes.
And she's an advocate. But share a little bit about her story and her involvement.
Yeah, so we're working with her because, of course, her father was an advocate of cannabis way back in the day. And so having the legacy of her being able to continue with her father's footsteps and partnering with us gives a strong history and legacy as we move this agenda forward.
It seems like getting celebrities and influencers to join the fight seems critical. So tell me, have you been successful in that? And who are you chasing down to, you know, raise the flag?
Yeah, there are some significant impact in the celebrity realm. Al Harrington, who was a former NBA player, just partnered with Allen Iverson. They released a strand about 2 weeks ago. Chris Webber is creating a $50 million fund to help minorities in the cannabis space in Detroit. So you're starting to have some celebrities and athletes who's starting to leverage their brands into the cannabis space, which only helps us all.
Yeah, so obviously you need the tools, you need the opportunity, and then let me make my way, like teaching a guy how to fish rather than giving him a fish. No one's looking for a handout.
No.
You just want to level the playing field and make it equal opportunity.
Yeah, my philosophy, let's own the fish pond. This is a strong economy, a strong industry. We know it's going to grow, and we want to be a part of it with minorities.
Well, that's awesome. Anything else you want to share on M4MM, Minorities for Medical Marijuana, a growing, burgeoning entity, and it's a 501c3, right?
Yes,
you're
yeah.
a nonprofit, but if people want to get involved or make a contribution?
Yes, they can come to our website, m4mmunited.org, m4mmunited.org.
Sweet. And you gave almost an invocation last night at this mixer. You have a little spiritual channeling going on. You got to share a little of your message.
Yes, sir. Well, I'm one of the few faith-based economists in the country, and so anytime I'm in front of an audience, I want to be able to share spirituality and know that God leads us where we need to go, and I was very fortunate to have a couple minutes last night to do that.
Well, it was awesome to hear you and catch up today and give our audience a chance to get to know you. Dr. Lance McCarthy here at MJ BizCon. Rich Walkov at America's Cannabis Conversation. We're having a blast and doing good deeds on the W420 Radio Network.
Are you interested in learning more about cannabis? Have you thought about starting your own cannabis business but don't know how? If so, we invite you to join the Cannabis Conversation with other people like you who are looking at the exciting opportunities in this exploding business. Listen to America's Cannabis Conversation. You'll hear from industry experts and get insights into the cannabis industry. For archived shows and for more information, log on to americascannabisconversation.com. It's time for Women in Cannabis on America's Cannabis Conversation, part of the W420 Radio Network.
Didn't you get the memo?
Here's Chase Roberts.
Welcome back to the conversation. This is Chase Roberts, Women in Cannabis correspondent for the W420 Radio Network. It is a pleasure to introduce Janelle Stelton-Holtmeyer. She's the editorial director of New Business Initiatives and Data at the Marijuana Business Daily. As mentioned in our part one of this two-part series, the third edition of the Women and Minorities in Cannabis Industry Report that was produced and researched by the team at MJ Biz Daily came out in late 2021 and contains many interesting findings. And today we're going to be digging a little deeper. Janelle, welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you here again.
Thanks for having me back again.
As mentioned in part one, the third edition of Women and Minorities in the Cannabis Industry Report that was produced and researched by the team at MJ Biz Daily came out. It contains so many interesting findings. Hoping this time around we can dig a little deeper. What do you feel is behind some of the numbers that have been found within the research you guys conducted?
Oh, there are so many things, but I think the number one thing is really the carry through of financing and funding that is so difficult for women and minorities to get access to these already established networks. And a lot of them just don't have a lot of their own money to tap into, or family members with extra money to tap into. This is a lot of people who are in the have been in the legacy market are looking for ways to get in, and it's an expensive endeavor.
It really is. And some of the points with the expenses that the average Joe might not realize is not only the cost of licensing, but getting property rentals to even rent space. A lot of landlords don't want to rent to these kind of industries. And then on top of that, I mean, it's in your document, you guys found it could cost up to $500,000 to just get started in the industry.
And honestly, in some markets can be way higher than that. It's, as you said, a lot of landlords really are hesitant. It's getting a little bit better in some of the markets, but they're really hesitant in part because of the continued federal illegality of the product. And then states and cities have put so many limits on where the real estate can even be. So it's highly competitive for them to, for operators to find space and be the person who can lock it in at a reasonable price. And then there's all the retrofitting that you have to do, because let's face it, there aren't a lot of cannabis businesses, whether retail or cultivation, that exist right now.
Yeah, or pre-designated buildings that are up to speed. I think also people that get in the industry don't realize how much water, power, all of that is going to cost up front. And the truth of the matter is, it is trying to break into the old boys club. You know, mm-hmm. It can be a huge barrier. Traditionally, financial networks are dominated by older white men. And it's just a matter of trying to find the capital.
And then there are social influences that come with that as well. One thing in my conversations with people in the industry, particularly on the investing side, is men come in with this idea of, you know, this is fun, this is our dream, this is great. Women come in with a plan.
Yeah.
And so you've got the people, the minorities who are people of color who are coming in as well with trying to, it's like, oh, I just have to keep this formal so you don't have all of these biases against me to start with.
Right. And you know what? I did want to talk about this bias of the disproportionate number of alleged minorities. I don't even like that word, to be honest, of people that are not allowed into the industry, and then also are the ones serving time still for infractions with cannabis.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big challenges with the industry right now and with federal legalization. What we're seeing is a disconnect between how do we properly account and provide reparations for the people who were inordinately damaged and hurt by the war on drugs over the last several decades. And part of that has to do with, you know, how do we deal with the people who are in prison right now for low-level nonviolent drug crimes?
Yeah, you guys pointed out in your report that people who identify as Black or African American accounted for 26.1% of all drug-related arrests in 2019. Which is just insane. But because at the same time, that demographic accounts for only 13.1% of the US population.
Mm-hmm.
So it is incredibly askew. And what are your personal thoughts, if I may ask, about expunging records or moving that forward?
Oh, I think there are so many problems personally with the current criminal justice system to begin with, that I think particularly for those nonviolent crimes, that are now legal, even if they weren't legal back then, I think absolutely there should be an expungement of the records. It just doesn't make sense to continue with what we've had.
Absolutely. It holds up so many processes. It holds so many people back. It really is unjust. And it's fully enveloped in the whole from, you know, the detaining to the being able to invest, to the being able to get the financial resources, to being allowed in the industry.
And with that, we're starting to see some states move away from this, but there's still the historical element of people with felony convictions, which felony by definition is established by individual states. There's no consistent definition of that. And so when you get into that, it's really difficult to figure out who can or cannot even participate at any level in this brand new opportunity.
We mentioned this in the previous interview, but it really, the cannabis industry is really mind-numbing in the sense that every part of it needs to find some universal conformity, which seems so ginormous for the United States specifically to unify on anything at this point.
Absolutely. And with what we've seen at the federal level, we're not even close to it. We just saw in December, the Safe Banking Act got stripped out of the last chance that it had for passing in 2021. It'll be hard to see what we end up with. And a lot of that has to do with disagreement about the role of social equity and providing these opportunities in those bills.
What do you think some of the main ways or that you discovered through research that you think to ensure social equity? I mean, access to finances is one, but are there any like advanced directives that you know about that can be beneficial?
Well, it's interesting. We're starting to see more approaches to it that may or may not work. Okay. New York has set aside a significant New York, which is still waiting to launch, set aside a significant portion of the tax revenues designated as having to be used for communities that were harmed. So what that looks like exactly, we don't know. But if they use it for things like improved housing, if they use it for improving education in these communities that really desperately need some attention, that could go a long way towards giving individuals in those communities a leg up. What we have seen as well that has shown a solid pathway towards more diversity is unlimited licenses, because that keeps going back to the funding element, that keeps the cost of the licensing lower because there's less competition on that level. So in Oregon, we see a fair amount of diversity because there are no limits on how many licenses can be issued. So it's not this, only the people with the most money can actually get the licenses.
Now, besides Oregon, do you know other states that have that kind of openness or is that the only one?
Oklahoma. Oklahoma has kind of been the dark horse in the cannabis industry. Nobody expected its medical program to explode like it did. It has the largest per capita participation rate in the medical registry at 5% of the population having signed up for medical cards. And so to get into the industry, to access this opportunity is so much easier there. And you're seeing a lot more people being able to compete and navigate and figure out how they can play a role.
Which is really important. I mean, let's just get back to the fact that this whole industry really has been restarted 30, 40 years ago because people needed access to marijuana, which they considered medicine.
Absolutely. And you hear it time and time again. I did an interview with Jeanette Ward Horton not that long ago about her program, which is New Project, which helps to fund Black and brown communities in the cannabis industry or cannabis adjacent industries. And one of the things that she highlighted was how she got in wasn't necessarily about the medicine, but really when she got in there, she understood and developed this massive passion for how this is a medicine.
Yeah. And you know, slowly as time goes on, hopefully it will become more universal in a concept that, it can in fact treat many things. I know also in the beginning, a lot of doctors were really hesitant to attach their name to coming out saying, hey, this is definitively good. This definitively helps this. I think there's still struggle in the industry with that a little bit. Do you find that as well in your own opinion?
Absolutely. And part of that is that because of the limitations at the federal level, research has been so restricted. Until recently, only one source of cannabis could be used for official research that received any federal funding, and that was the University of Mississippi. And what they've found recently is that the strains that were being provided by the University of Mississippi have very little in common with what's commercially available.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's really concerning.
And absolutely.
Do you know why the University of Mississippi was the only one to receive that kind of federal funding?
It was, I don't have the full history on that, unfortunately, in front of me.
No, but just something for listeners to consider that, you know, the research isn't there. Therefore, the credibility sometimes can't be attached to it. And
but that is improving. We are seeing more outfits being licensed by the DEA to provide materials for research, and that's manufacturers and growers, so that better research with more
backing
with more applicable product,
there we go.
With more realistic product available, so that we can get real research on what's being done.
And I'm going to take us a little off topic, but there has been rumors of the DEA actually investing in cannabis. Have you heard this?
I've heard rumors. I have no confirmation of anything whatsoever.
I don't as well, but I was just curious to see if you had even heard anything about that.
What I have heard, like I said, is the licensing. They are licensing manufacturers to be able to provide materials to research labs.
Yeah. And moving forward with your research for 2022, what are the reports you're going to be focusing on this year? And what can our listeners look forward to as far as data that's going to be coming out?
Well, every year we publish our marijuana business fact book, and that will be coming out in April. And that really gets into really the state of the industry right now across sectors and across states, to provide really anyone who's looking to get into the industry more details on what the markets look like and what the competition looks like, but is also useful for people who are in the industry to really benchmark themselves against their competition in those different states. In addition, we are going to be moving the Women and Minorities Report up into an annual cycle as opposed to a two-year cycle. So you'll be able to see that again.
Great.
Plus, we will continue to see where data is available and needed. As our audience reaches out to us, we look for ways to really incorporate more of the data that and really provide more of the data that the industry needs.
Yeah. And if our listeners work for a company that want to provide data to you for any consideration, is there some page they should go to or email they should submit information to?
The easiest way to reach out to us is just to email editorial@mjbizdaily.com.
So easy and effective. Janelle, our time is already up. I want to thank you again for being here. I hope to have you back in April when the other findings come out. And for our listeners, if you missed any of this great interview, part two and part one with Janelle Stelton-Haltmeyer, you can go to W420 Radio Network and click on the archive section. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. I'm David Katzmeyer here with a very special guest from Emerald Sky. We're going to talk about some of the edibles that they offer and the story about how the company began. First, let me read a little bit from their website at emeraldskyedibles.com. Cannabis infused edibles that go further. Emerald Sky is well known for its delicious, all-natural cannabis infused edibles. We don't allow artificial colors or flavors in any of our products, and each and every bite is 100% pesticide-free. We are located in 400 dispensaries throughout California. Our candy-making experience dates back to 1989. We started our cannabis-infused brand in 2018 and have five exceptionally unique product lines that cover nearly every category of confection sold in America today. Epitomizing a lip-smacking adventure in every single bite, Emerald Sky is truly unique. And here to talk about it is Emerald Sky founder, Josh Taylor. Josh, welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation.
Thank you so very much. I'm honored and delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're glad to hear you, to talk to you, because I think you have an interesting story and an interesting success. Apparently, people like the products that you have. I want to talk a little bit about them. I mean, because I see that you offer gummies, hard fruit drops, licorice, peanut butter cups, cream-filled chocolate cookies, vegan gummies, and you do wholesale. So I want to get into a little bit about that. I'm mighty curious about them. But first, Josh, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your story, about how the company got started. I think our listeners would like to learn a little bit about that. So tell me, Josh, how did it come about?
Sure. So I've been in the candy business, candy and confections, for a very long time, for most of my career. I started making chocolate bars back in 1990 and placed the first chocolate bars ever into Whole Foods back in 1991. And I made the first organic chocolate bars in America in 1993. And so I've had a long career making chocolates and gummies, hard candies, licorice, all kinds of confection products, breath mints, chewing gum. It's been an industry that I've enjoyed and have had good success in. And back in 2016, I decided to go to a cannabis trade show that was taking place in Oakland. And I walked around the show and saw a few edibles brands, a few flower and other types of cannabis brands. But I thought the edibles of that trade show was very understated. There wasn't much there. And what was there wasn't well conceived, wasn't well packaged, and didn't seem like it was well organized as a brand. So I thought this would be a very interesting industry to go into because it seemed so young and so new. Now, the tricky part that came about through researching entering this category, this class of trade, was the infusion. So I have a co-founder, Nathan Weiss, who's in the factory today manufacturing peanut butter cups and gummies. And we spent 2 years together doing all different types of R&D styles and methodologies and techniques, because our goal was to create the most accurate cannabis infusion edibles company in the world. And so we researched a lot of very unique equipment, and we developed a new process that is now patent pending at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And we have succeeded in our goal of creating the world's most successful and precise infusion company. So it's been a very, very interesting challenge that we were faced with, that plus all the compliance regulations from the state of California that, of course, that we comply with. And now we are in our 31st consecutive month of passing what we call third-party lab trials. So every batch of edibles product in the California that is produced by every single company must be sent out for third-party lab trials. And we are the only cannabis company in the state out of about 200 of them. We're the only company that never has any fails. So we're very proud of our accomplishment, and we're proud of how people enjoy our products as a result of what we do. So we're pleased to where we've gotten to today.
Well, apparently consumers appreciate the professionalism that you're bringing into this because they're consuming your product. You know, a lot of people in the gold rush of legalization that we've been on riding this wave is a lot of people go into being manufacturing products and creating edibles and becoming chocolatiers because they wanted to sell cannabis. But you already had experience in the fields of production. And so you are a producer who came to cannabis rather than somebody who wanted to sell cannabis and decided, well, I'm going to become a producer to do it right now. So you're not a Johnny come lately. And that professionalism is what produces your results. It's amazing how quickly your company took off. You can only do that with very successful sales. So apparently people like your products. Now, what part of the market are you appealing to? How do you distribute your products to the public?
We distribute them via a distributorship that we do not own, but we are one of their 40 or 50 brands. And they are called Nabis, N-A-B like boy, I-S, Nabis Distribution. And they carry our product from their storage facilities into all our accounts. So we go out there to these accounts, our extensive sales team, we write orders and we submit them, and then our distributor, who has the 60 or so vehicles, delivers them around the state within 48 hours.
Well, Josh, tell me, there's many ways to consume cannabis products. Of course, there's smoking, there's vaping, there's various types of tinctures and CBDs and everything like this, but clearly we have found a big demand for edibles. Why do people like edibles so much?
I think that some people, there's no question that there are many people who just do not want to put smoke into their lungs, hands down. They don't want to even put vapes into their lungs. I've known people who, who've experienced some injury from those methodologies. Edibles provides a much more, in a sense, a user-friendly, less intrusive way of experiencing the benefits of THC, because you don't have to have anything entering your air passages. There are just people who do not like that. And I think in an older demographic, that older demographic prefers edibles for the same reason. Maybe they smoked when they were younger. Now they're 50, they're 60, they're 70, and they surely do not want to be inhaling things. A wide acceptance that way.
And the effects are different too, are they not?
That is correct. They take quite a bit longer to feel, so you want to plan it when you're going to consume an edible. But then the effects can last for many more hours than by smoking or inhaling a vape. Yes. If you take an edible, say an hour before sleep, and it starts to kick in, it endures, and you can get very profound sleep from an edible an hour and a half before bed.
And you produce an array of different ways of taking your product, from gummies to drops and licorice and peanut butter cups and chocolate cookies and gummies and everything like that. But indeed, I see that there are a lot of stores that carry your product, and people can find store locators that carry Emerald Sky products. And they can look in the stores for the products with that beautiful green logo that you have just by clicking on the store locator and seeing a map of where they can find your products. So tell me, did you have to, other than California is very regulated these days, and you have consistently passed the high standards of California and never faltered. When you were starting up the company, did you encounter major obstacles along your way, or how was it getting this off the ground? It usually takes more energy to get something started than to keep it going. So how was that ride, Josh?
That's a very true statement. Drafting the original SOP, the standard operating procedures of Emerald Sky, to the acceptance of the state of California was a many months long process with three people almost full time involved, numerous reiterations required by the state of California. And getting that done was a bear. But now that it's done, we only have to visit it once a year, see if there are any minor tweaks that we do. So you're exactly right. Getting started is harder than maintaining.
So what are your outlook for the future? Are you going to continue with your lines? Are you looking to develop any new products? Or how's your plan for maybe the next 5 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are now taking our, now that we've accomplished most of our goals in the state of California, the most competitive state, we are beginning to look at the other states. We are speaking to some investment firms who typically invest in cannabis and looking at the idea of raising capital, bringing on partners to expand into, you know, Illinois, Oklahoma, Massachusetts, Colorado, Washington, et cetera, et cetera. There are plenty of legal states to choose from, and our products are very unique, so we think we can do very well there. We're really the only peanut butter cup company, and peanut butter cups is a huge piece of our business. We've had easily 100 people come up to us at trade shows and other events and say that our peanut butter cups is the number one edible they've ever tasted, ever. We have a lot of confidence in that product. It sells well basically in every store we put it in. So we're looking at a, you know, I can't say a national expansion because it's not recreationally legal in every state, but a significant expansion into 10, 12, 15, ultimately 20 states with our peanut butter cups and our gummy products. We are also looking to increase our store distribution in California. There are about 800 dispensaries. Some are too small to work with for us, but there are probably another 150 to 200 that we would like to see our brand inside. And then we're also working on new products. We are in the midst of developing a sugar-free gummy, which we think will do a very nice amount of business for us. So we're always looking to grow in all the avenues that are open to us. We've even been keeping an eye on the market in Mexico, which is now legal, but there are still no permits. So we've actually have already invested in having our production lines are sitting in Mexico City waiting for regulation and licenses to be passed. So we're ready to move into that market as early as we can.
Well, that would be extraordinary. And if consumers in the other states like your products as much as they do in California, you will surely find as much success there. And every state that you go in will be a unique set of rules, won't it, for your startup and their own regulations, because everything is on the state level, isn't it?
The brutal part. If you're in 20 states, that means you're complying with 20 separate set of regulations. No way you do that without a couple of full-time compliance officers.
There really is a lot in the backroom work of setting up a production line, getting it out to the public. This is not something for a mom-and-pop store. This is best done by a professional first who goes into cannabis second to bring the professionalism in, which is what happened here at Emerald Sky. But we sure wish you all the luck wherever you go. Folks, go out there and look for Emerald Sky products. You'll find them in your stores. Check out their site at emeraldskyedibles.com. And Josh Taylor from Emerald Sky, I sure do appreciate you coming on America's Cannabis Conversation and sharing your story with us.
And my pleasure as well. I thank you, David. I always love talking about the brand, and it's a pleasure to speak with you about the brand and our background on your show.
I'm David Katzmeier here with America's Cannabis Conversation. You can hear this interview and all of our archives at W420RadioNetwork.com.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. W420RadioNetwork.com.